welcome back to HE Podcast, a series where we explore and understand how research works in the environment and ecology and how its implementation can pull us out of climate doom. The HE Podcast is your one-stop shop of curated content on conservation, sustainability, and the environment. This is your host, Namrata Murli. Today, we're in conversation with Dr. Siddappa Shetty, convener of Center for Environment and Development at ATRI. Dr. Shetty is an ethnobotanist focused on the ecological, social, and economic aspects of forest resource, sustainable use, and participatory resource monitoring. He is keen to alleviate poverty in indigenous communities through sustainable use of forest resources. Let's dive right in and explore all the work the Center for Environment and Development is doing. Welcome, Dr. Siddappa.
Namaste, Namrata.
Getting right into it, Siddappa, what is the purpose of the Center for Environment and Development, and how is the center's goals intertwined with the UN mandated Sustainable Development Goals number 15, number 6, and number 13?
Well, thank you very much. That's a nice question, Namrata. And the Center for Environment and Development is a very, very critical issue. I'm glad we have this center embedded in ATRI's program. The Center for Environment and Development at ATRI addresses the critical issues at the interface of environment and development, particularly related to forest, that Sustainable Development Goal 15. And the secondly, the water and sanitation, the Sustainable Development Goal 6. And thirdly, the climate change, that's Sustainable Development Goal 13. Under the forest, you might be knowing in the forest, we have a very limited forest landscapes, and associated with those forests, we have indigenous community around 6 million living inside the forest and outside the forest for millennia. And the forest are declaring as tiger reserves, protected areas, and things like that. There are a lot of challenges. So, in that context, under the forest theme, the Center for Environment and Development, under forest theme, Sustainable Development Goal 15, we are, influence the forest policy discourse in South Asia through research and action that incorporates forest ecology, human well-being, the changing socioeconomic contexts, the historically situated and locally nuanced forest right arrangements, and the trade-offs and synergies between local and global stakeholders. In that sense, in the Forest Right Act, we have been working quite extensively under the Forest Right Act for quite some time. And our work in MMLs and BRLs, Tiger Reserve, and I'll come to that a little later, has made a lot of difference. This is in the first time in the history of protected areas we are able to implement Forest Right Act, and the communities received individual rights and also community rights to use their resources in the forest. Because earlier some of our studies indicated that and people need tenure and they need a security and they need to have ownership on the resources, then they would be interested in conserving and sustainably use them. If they do not have ownership, why would they conserve? So this is clearly some of our results of our research indicated. And based on that, we thought it's a good opportunity to work under Forest Right Act, try to get their rights to them. And it will be we can better involve them in conservation of the forest and livelihood of the communities can be enhanced through these things. And some of our colleagues, Dr. Sharad Chandra Lele, is also working on these issues. And say, for example, in estimating and mapping CFR, Forest Right, Community Forest Act potential in Madhya Pradesh and Maharashtra is working. And they are also analyzing the transformative and potential of CFR rights, that is Community Forest Right. And also they are focusing and concentrating on community forest resource rights implementation in Chhattisgarh as well. And these are the focus area under the forest right, under theme forest, under Sustainable Development Goal 15. And now I'll talk about water and sanitation. Yeah, under water and sanitation, the second theme, the Sustainable Development Goal 6, there our team is dedicated and focusing on generate the policy insights into various uses of water in domestic agriculture and industries. It's a very, very important issue on the aspect. The underlying causes of inequality of access to water, sanitation, unsustainable extraction of groundwater and water pollution, and the vulnerability of water resources, and carry out capacity building to help identify social, technological and governance solution to India's water and sanitation problem across rural, urban and peri-urban areas. This is the focus area of the water and sanitation team. And in particularly currently, sustainable use of natural resources to improve human wealth and support economic development. That is the project that Priyanka is working with. And also Srinivas Bedegar is training engineers under the Enabling Integrated Water Resource Management in Karnataka, IWRM program. He conducted 3 to 4 programs per year, where he has already trained around 125 engineers on integrated water resource management. This is going to be very crucial and important work. Under the climate change theme, Sustainable Development Goal 13, we have scientists, and also it's a cross-cutting thing. Some of our PhD students and some of our project is also focused on these issues. That's related to carry out research on the links between developmental goals, local environmental goals, and the mitigation of GHG emissions, including the trade-offs and synergies between biodiversity, local livelihoods, and renewable energy, carbon sequestration policies, related issues.
Through the center's work, 64 Gram Sabhas have received community rights. 2,000 households receive land under the Forest Rights Act. Why are these provisions underutilized, and what are the problems faced while you try to make use of these provisions?
As I said earlier, it was very clear in this landscape, especially the BRT Tiger Reserve and MML's Wildlife Sanctuary, we have been working with the Soligar tribal communities more than 25 years. What we clearly understood from these studies or some of our research is that, and they need a ownership on the resource. If they don't have ownership, and it's very difficult for them to get them involved in conservation of the forest and monitoring related issues. So once what happened was there was no right to harvest the resources. There was a Supreme Court, the government banned the community to go to forest to use the resources. At that time, what happened was the plenty of resources were available in the forest, but they were not able to go and harvest them, use them for their subsistence. At that time, all the local people outside the reserve, the protected areas, came and harvested everything very badly. And the resource were like a damaged, the most of the trees were damaged. I've seen in my own eyes. And then I went and spoke to the people, why they could have gone and protected them and all. They said, we do not have rights to go to the forest. Why should we bother about protecting them? That was the answer I got from them. And also I was doing participatory resource monitoring and mapping techniques, and basically to address sustainable use related issues. And they said they don't want to do mapping. Why would they mapping if they are not using the resource? And the lack of interest, it was going down. They are not like sure about conserving their own forest. So under the Forest Rights Act, they were able to get the right. We thought when Forest Rights Act came into picture, we thought it's a good opportunity to get their rights, and we can strengthen their capacity to conserve the resources. That's what we thought. And then we started working on this. Unfortunately, and 77 Gram Sabhas have received the community rights. We did it through their institutions, the ATRI. This is the first time in the history of protected area we are able to get community rights. There are 83 villages, around 5,433 families, and 21,732 members have received the rights to use the resources. And also there was uncertainty when they declare, after Wildlife Protection Act, they declared entire landscape into wildlife sanctuary. And 2010, it was declared as tiger reserve. And all this declaration made them uncertainty and then unhappy, and they were not able to, they were really totally unhappy about these policies. At that time, the Forest Right Act gave them an opportunity to get their rights and continue to live in the forest. So under that, 2,000 people used to cultivate agriculture land without ownership. There was no ownership, and it was uncertain. The uncertainty was very high. The forest department could have asked them to go out from the landscape anytime. So this helped, Forest Right Act helped them, and getting right over 2,000 people receiving land rights under Forest Right Act was very important for their life and for the subsistence livelihood, for their future, and the future of their education of their children. So in that sense, it was very important for us to work on these issues, and it was possible to get their rights under this act.
So it is clear that it's important to involve the vulnerable populations and help them co-manage the forest. So what kind of changes in policy regulations do we need to see to enhance this collaboration?
When the government of India prepare and they come up with the policies, they have to make sure they do a proper consultation with the community and their institutions, get their feedback and inputs to strengthen the policies, make it inclusive, instead of top-down approach. They have to follow bottom-up approach, and then it would make a difference. And local people will have a stake, and there it will strengthen their capacity to manage the resources they have. And they can factor their experiences and their strengths and what they can contribute and how they can contribute to sustain protect these resources. Those things can be, those ideas can be factored in these policies. And absolutely, I would encourage local consultation and interaction with the community. Inclusive participation of the community is going to be very important and very crucial to strengthen these policies.
This is so interesting that they're all interlinked. Coming to the communities and their livelihoods, you worked with the Soliga tribe and you've worked closely with them to produce coffee. Could you elaborate on some of the achievements that you were able to do with that project?
Sure. Thank you, Namrata, for that question. These are protected areas. Soliga tribal communities, they used to do sifting cultivation and hunting. And they are not a traditional cultivators, actually. And they used to cultivate traditional crops in this landscape in a very, very small scale for their household use, with this 1 to 1.5 acre piece of land they have received from the Forest Department earlier. Because of the declaration of the tiger reserves and wildlife sanctuary status first and tiger reserve status later, a number of the wildlife, especially elephant, wild boar, barking deer, sambar deer population have increased quite significantly in this landscape. And they started coming to their agriculture land. And they started raiding their agriculture land. And there used to be human-wildlife conflict. The result of this human-wildlife conflict, and people have started thinking about growing coffee in this landscape. This is a recent development from past 15 years or 10 years. Because I associated with this landscape from more than 25 years. And past 15 years, there was absolutely not many people growing coffee. And because of the wildlife, human-wildlife conflict within this landscape, and they started going for a coffee. The coffee is not consumed by elephant or other herbivores. It's quite safe in that sense. And they started growing, and then Atri was interested in, and myself is interested in working with them on coffee, because once they start growing coffee, they might have to increase the yield in their agriculture land. They might end up in using insecticide, pesticide, inorganic manure, and things like that. If they started using this kind of inputs, and what happens to the biodiversity? Because the cultivation is being done in the core area of the tiger reserve or wildlife sanctuary. So it's a very good time, high time, and important time to get involved with them and encourage them to cultivate forest-friendly coffee, so that they will get a premium rate to their coffee. At the same time, the biodiversity will stay intact. They will not get impacted when they start cultivating this coffee without insecticide, pesticide, inorganic compost, etc. That is one of the goals, actually. And we started working with 600 farmers. Currently, we have 600 soligas cultivating coffee. Unfortunately, had a small funding for that. And we are collaborating with the Rainforest Alliance. And they are experts in working with the coffee cultivators on the certification, Rainforest Alliance certification. And we are training, and we identified 17 lead farmers and working with 600 coffee growers and increase them to sustainably cultivate the coffee, organically cultivate the coffee. So the biodiversity will stay safe. At the same time, we are trying to get organic certification, Rainforest Alliance certification for them. Once we have the certification, they can able to sell their coffee for the premium rate. Even they can export them. And that is the incentive I'm looking for them to conserve the biodiversity in this landscape and not to use inorganic compost or whatever it is to sustain the and maintain the soil health in this landscape. And that's a great opportunity because, you know, they are not traditional coffee cultivators. When you go and visit their coffee farm, it's not being done properly. And the seedlings not being done, planted very randomly. Their land look very thick. If it is, it's very thick, the yield will go down. They do not have a proper collection practices, the fruit collection practices and processing practices. They just randomly do it. And we trained all these things, you know, good agriculture practices, number one, and good fruit harvest practices, number two, and good processing practices and drying practices, number three, and good preservation practices, number four. And these are being followed stepwise. And people are very curious and they're very effectively doing it now. Just we have completed more than 1 year and people are requesting us to continue this project for 3 more years. Hope we'll get a funding for this. We are looking for some funding.
So apart from coffee, you've been monitoring rock honeybees and wild food plants in the area. So could you tell us why this is important? Should young conservationists be doing things like this as well? Could you tell us a little bit more?
The monitoring, especially the long-term monitoring, is a very, very important in conservation field. When you want to do a research and you want to come up with a management plan, to protect these resources at the species level, at the landscape level. You need to monitor these resources for a long time. The ITRI is committed to do it. Whether if you get a project or not, and there will be some internal funding mobilization so that you monitor the resources for more than 10 years, 15 years. In that sense, the Apis dasata honeybee colonies are being monitored by my team, myself, for more than 25 years. And if you have these 25 years of data, you know what's happening with this species, what's happening to them, how the bee colony numbers are changing, are really going up, are coming down, and remains the same. And if you have 1 or 2 years data, and you would, it won't tell you what's happening exactly, and you will not be able to understand what's happening. You'll be end up in, you know, taking a wrong decision sometimes. So if you have a long-term data that would help you to understand what's happening, what is the story, and what is the kind of impact these species are facing, and how to tackle them with community participation, this kind of decision one can make. That is the advantage of it. So we are seeing a small decline in bee colony number in this landscape, and there are various other reasons. The invasive species problem is quite huge in this landscape. The 70 to 80% of the dry deciduous forest in this landscape is full of lantana. You do not have, the bees doesn't have a resource at the herb layer and the shrub layer. They only have a resource at the tree layer. So in that sense, they are losing the resources at the ground and the lower canopy and the middle canopy, so that the number of colonies are getting impacted. That's one of the reasons. And also, these are migratory bees. They migrate from hilltop to agriculture land. They spend only 3 to 3.5 months in forest landscape, and rest of the time they are in agriculture land and the urban landscape. You don't know what's happening in this landscape. In agriculture land, people use insecticide and pesticides that might kill bees. The bees are incredible pollinators. 60 to 80% of the agriculture land and the forest landscapes are being pollinated by these bees. And it's very, very important for us to conserve these bee colonies, the bees, especially pollinators. Otherwise, you know, it will be very, very difficult. And the food security is depending upon this one. So that's one of the things. And the second one, wild food plants. And one of my colleagues, Harisha, and our team is focusing on this aspect. In fact, did his PhD on this. And we found out that 135 species are being used by indigenous communities in these landscapes. That is that brings a cultural value, and they bring food security, and they bring nutritional value for them. In that sense, it's very, very important for us to conserve these food plants in this landscape, and also the traditional knowledge associated with this important food plants are very, very important and crucial. The center is dedicated and committed to work on these issues. We have a coffee table book coming up soon to talk about more about food plants and awareness on this, how to use them in large scale and how to cultivate them and use them in large scale, not from the forest directly. So these are the issues we'll be addressing under this center and the team. In BRT also, the BRT tiger reserve also, there are unique plants are being used for unique purposes, even treat some diseases. And this knowledge need to be protected and conserved. At the same time, we need to use these resources sustainably. That's the goal.
It's so exciting to hear that we're coming up with a book for indigenous wild food plants, because it seems like everything and everywhere you look, it's the exact same food everyone's eating, and there's no exciting ingredients left anymore. And going back to when you were talking about the rock honeybees, you mentioned that lantana is creating a lot of chaos and changing the landscape. Could you tell us a little bit more about what ATRI and the center is doing to change this and work towards the lantana control?
Thank you very much indeed for this question. It's very, very important and very crucial one. and need really high and big attention for this invasive species related issues, and everybody should be focusing on this. Because, you know, this invasive species, the Lantana camara, has started invading, and it came to India around 250 years back, and now it is encroaching all our biodiversity landscapes. Even in BRT and MMLs, 25 years back I started working, there's not much Lantana, I'll tell you. And the population has started increasing slowly. Now the 70% of the forest is full of Lantana. You can imagine. The dry deciduous forest especially. And 25 years back, it was a 5%. And 15 years back, it was around 30%. And now it is more than 50% overall. In deciduous forest, it's more than 70%. And this is having an incredible negative impact on biodiversity, especially native plant species. The native plant species, the population is declining quite significantly in this landscape. And we are thinking about what to do with this and what can you do out of Lantana. Those are the questions we are thinking, and those are all the burning questions we are thinking to answer. At the same time, when you go to MMLs, and people used to use bamboo to make baskets and furnitures and other household products out of bamboo. And the bamboo population was declining. At the same time, the wildlife population, especially elephant, all herbivores, they feed on bamboo. And also people also depend on bamboo. They harvest bamboo during the sprouting season, and they make curry out of it. That also gives nutritional security for some extent for the indigenous communities. In that sense, the conserving bamboos was important. At the same time, you need to get rid of Lantana. And these were the thinking, issues we were thinking. And we started working on instead of using bamboo, we encouraged Soliga tribal community to use Lantana in this landscape. First time myself and Ramesh Kandan visited Natham, Andhra Pradesh, where people used to make baskets out of Lantana. We came back and we encouraged people to produce bamboo Lantana baskets. And they started working, but Lantana was a little bit sturdy compared to bamboo. And we were not able to make a dent. After that, we got to know that there's a person called Dr. Anil Joshi in Madhya Pradesh, Dehradun. He had a Lantana village at the time in Dehradun. So Professor Umashankar asked myself and Ramesh Kannan to visit these places. Both of us traveled together to Dehradun. And we saw what they're doing out of Lantana. It was amazing. And we got back and then sent 4 people from MMLs to get trained for Lantana furniture making. They got back and they started training more people. At that time, I was very busy, and then Ramesh Kandam was coordinating that project. And then the 4 people, we increased to 6 and 10, 15, and now we have 300 to 400 artisans in MMLs. And they went ahead and trained other people. And there are a lot of invitations from different places for them to go and train other people in Kerala, Maharashtra, Karnataka, Tamil Nadu, and part of Tamil Karnataka, and things like that. And they were also getting paid for that. And there's also income for them. And some of these master craftsmen went ahead and trained 300 more people, around 400 more people outside Karnataka. And now we have 1,000 artisans in South India. That was one of the major contributions of these artisans of MMLs. I'm really grateful to them. And these 300 artisans, they work, and they started using Lantana to make furnitures. And it's been going on from past 15 years, and they were able to use quite a bit of Lantana to make furnitures. And last month I was there in the field, I was having a discussion with the artisans. They were saying that Lantana is a resource for them, not invasive species anymore. And I was talking to them, you want to remove Lantana, get rid of them completely. You know, what do you think about it? I had a question for them. They said, no, sir, you don't do that. It's a resource for them. And don't harvest Lantana, send somewhere else. And we want to use it for our livelihood. That is what they were saying. And fortunately, we had the collaboration makes a lot. You know, we will not be able to achieve each and everything. The synergy is very, very important. In this aspect, we collaborated with Chola Trust, Tastek Karan, and they were producing life-size elephants made out of Lantana. We got them, we involved with them, and our artisans also started making life-size elephants made out of Lantana. And from past 15 years, and we have produced more than 80 different varieties of furnitures, including life-size elephants. And from past 15 years, they were able to earn 1.2 crores. That's quite a lot of money to the Soliga community. Because based on our studies, you know, the Soliga's income used to be around $1 to $2 per day and 6,000, 7,000 per year. It was increased to 36,000. And then recently we did some ecological monitoring related study where, and you can clearly, we have mapped, we have a GIS and remote sensing map. We are analyzing the data, but it's clearly indicated that close to their villages, around 2 to 3 kilometers, they played an important role in terms of using them to make furnitures, and the population of the Lantana density is declining. That's really a good sign, isn't it? So the population is declining, at the same time people are getting better and the livelihood is increasing. They were able to send their children to the school and get them educated. And this is a win-win situation and sustainable model, I would say. This need to be replicated all over the world, all over the country. And I also had a request from Africa, and they would need some help to replicate this model, as I'm working on that. Oh, the Lantana, the model which I explained, that is going on in MMLs. And there are some landscape you are not able to do it because of the, you know, especially in national parks and tiger reserves, because there is a policy issues there. And the forest managers and the government of India should revise this policy and encourage people to use this Lantana and get rid of this Lantana. And we need to come up with the value-added products and, you know, high economic important, you know, the products. And then it's important to use these resources for some useful things. Recently with the CSEI, we are able to produce particle boards out of Lantana. This need to be encouraged. And people are talking about insecticide and pesticide made out of Lantana stems and the leaves. This need to be encouraged. Then you are coming up with the high value products out of Lantana so that you are generating some income to get rid of this Lantana. At the same time, you can use those income to restore this landscape. And this is what we should be thinking. And the Center for Environment and Development is collaborating with the CSEI within Atria Center to achieve these goals. Hope we'll be able to make a dent on this. And hope the forest managers and policymakers would understand these issues and work on this to enhance the livelihood in the communities in this landscape, at the same time restore Lantana harvested areas in these landscapes.
And it seems like our tryst with Lantana has reached a bittersweet cycle, right? British introduced Lantana to our forests, and now our Lantana elephants are on display in all the British palaces and all over London and United Kingdom. So it's really nice to see this, and finally there is some much needed attention on the damage caused by the invasive species, like you said. So thank you, Dr. Sidhappa, for joining us today. It was a great conversation. As always, I learned a lot from talking to you, and hope to speak to you soon again on this platform and otherwise. Thank you.
You're welcome, Namrata. Thanks a lot.
Stay tuned to our channel for more insights into the environment and the problems we face globally. Do subscribe to our channel to stay connected.